they'd prefer them to be. I got tired of sewing. So tired that even early in the morning, I do negligent things like lose my focus as I slip the fabric beneath the presser foot and seam right through the armhole of a garment. Then I'd have to turn it into a tank top just to salvage it, and I knew that nobody was allowed to show their shoulders at Fire and Brimstone, not even babies. I decided I didn't want to sew anymore, but I had all those scraps, whole bags of scraps, brown and green and black, and even some velvet that must have come from making an altar cloth, because nobody wore velvet. I tried to think of what to do with all the scraps that wouldn't hurt my fingers so much. One day I was laying back on my bed, and I noticed the rug on the floor. I started studying it, looking at how the pieces were woven together, and how when the rug maker had run out of one piece of cloth, she just started in with another one, and how it didn't really matter when the fabric knotted up. I thought I could do that if I put together a loom. All I'd need was some pieces of wood and some nails. I started sketching out how a loom would have to look on pieces of notebook paper, holding up the rug, measuring it with my tape measure. When Daddy came to visit, I said, "When you get a chance, could you bring me some nails and a hammer and some scrap wood from the barn?" He laughed at me. "What are you making?" "I'm not sure yet." He brought it to me, and one morning when Grandpa Herman was gone, I built a little loom. Nana came in when she heard the racket I was making, and I told her about my idea.
"Well, you won't be able to use just regular thread on it," she said.
"What can I use?"
"I don't know."
"Nana, can you get me some tobacco twine?" I asked her. She brought me back the twine and fishing line, too, and some old burlap tobacco sheets that she washed out for me. So I started weaving. Because my loom was so little, my rugs were little, too. At first I couldn't keep the scraps of fabric rolled up tight enough, but after some practice I got better. I showed one to Daddy, and he said,
"Well, that's great, baby, except where are you going to use them little rugs?"
"I'm going to hook them all together later," I told him. The next time he came, he brought me a bigger loom that he'd built, and it held together better than the one I'd made. Nana took the rugs and put them all over her house. By Christmas time, I had made a rug for every house at Fire and Brimstone, and even though we didn't usually give presents, I had one for everybody. Nana gave them out for me, because I missed the family Christmas. By January, I'd gotten brave again. One Sunday morning, when I felt big as the side of the house, when I felt like I'd die if I didn't step outside, I peeked out the window while everybody filed into church. I waited until church had been started for 10 minutes or so, and then I left. I hadn't been out since the day of my dunking. I hadn't seen anybody at all, except for Daddy and Nana and Grandpa, who visited regularly. I watched Mama sometimes from the window, and when it was time for the bus, I waved goodbye to Pammy and Mustard, but all they saw was my face. Just smelling the coldness, the winter smell of firewood smoldering out chimneys, and the sound of pine needles half frozen and tinkling in the wind was enough to wake me up. And all that land, all those fields and trees and all that dirt, it was a happy remembering. I walked down the road to the chicken coop, wandered inside and spoke to the hens on their nests. Some of them came running towards me, thinking I was going to feed them, and since I didn't want to trick them, I tossed out a handful of scratch for them to snack on. I went into the stable, sniffing hard at the hoarseness, stopping at each stall to rub their heads and watch the puffs of their warm breathing clouding up the air as it passed through their nostrils. I even visited with the pigs. I'd never really understood the pigs, and I only stayed there for a minute. Walking back towards the house, I got carried away by the beauty of the place, the closeness of everybody. I missed being able to walk from house to house, sit down by a fire and be treated like I belonged there. I remembered the winter before, when it had snowed. James had backed out the tractor, and Barley tied a rope to the back of it, hooked an old one-man boat to the rope, and we'd all climbed in, everybody except James, who was driving. He'd pulled us through the snow in that boat, and we'd spun wide circles in the middle of the field, laughing and singing Christmas carols, even though Christmas was over, bumping into each other every time he turned. I remembered how later we all sat on the floor at Grandpa Herman and Nana's, and Grandpa Herman was in one of his better moods, and he thanked God for the snow and for allowing us to enjoy it so much. Nana'd made cider, and everybody, children and grown-ups alike, had a cup, and we sung hymns together. Uncle Ernest and Aunt Kate brought out the guitar and banjo, and even though they never got them tuned the same, we didn't mind. Daddy played his harmonica and passed it to David, who blew in it for a while, and passed it to me, and I put it right up to my mouth, not even caring much that it had other people spit on it. And I played it too, until Mustard took it from me. I got so carried away, remembering all the things I loved about Fire and Brimstone, that I walked right to Mama and Daddy's house without thinking about it, without remembering that I was pregnant and didn't live there anymore. When I opened the door, everybody jumped. Olin and Mustard and Daddy, sitting at the table playing cards on a Sunday morning. "Nina!" Mustard hollered, and ran up and hugged me before he remembered how old he was and backed away. Daddy was picking up the cards quick, trying to stuff them back into their little card holder, but some dropped onto the floor. "Hello, girl," Olin said, and walked up to me and hugged me too. "How have you been?" He didn't even look at my stomach. "Good, I guess," I stammered. "I hope it's all right. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I forgot where I lived, I guess." Then Daddy walked over, shyly, sliding the deck of cards into his back pocket and grinning like he knew he'd been caught. "Does anybody know you're out?" "No, sir," I said. "I just needed some air. I thought everybody'd be in church. Why didn't you go?" "I was feeling a little peaked this morning." And he smiled. "You won't tell them what you seen, will you?" I laughed outright, and they all laughed too. "Long as you don't tell nobody you saw me." "Sit down a while," Mustard said. "What time is it?" I asked. 20 minutes till 12. "I can only stay for a second," I claimed. "God only knows what they'll do to me if they find out I slipped away." "You're looking good," Olin said, and then he blushed. "We'll be glad when you're back with us, running around with the rest of the children." It surprised me to hear him say that. I hadn't thought about what would happen when the baby was born. But one thing I knew for sure was that I didn't feel like a child anymore. I couldn't imagine myself running around with anybody. "You gas the tobacco beds yet?" I asked Daddy. We were all a little nervous, and I thought farm talk might be just the thing to ease the mood. "Did that before Christmas," Daddy told me. "Olin mixed the seeds yesterday." "Nope. Didn't get around to it. We'll have to do that this afternoon." "All right," Daddy added. "If you'll let me stay home from school tomorrow, I'll help you sew them," Mustard promised.
"You going to school?"
Olin and Daddy both said. "Supposed to rain around the middle of next week," I piped in. "At least that's what Grandpa said."
"That's what we're hoping," Daddy claimed. "Beat the seeds in the ground and we can get the beds covered."
Then he glimpsed at his watch and said, "Honey, it's good to see you out, but you got to go. I don't think I can stand to watch you get punished again. All right?" "Okay," I told him. "But I need to get something first." I hurried to my room, dug around in my closet, and pulled out the rope that had held James to the tree. I wrapped it quickly around my middle and belted the blanket I was wearing as a coat. They all watched me leaving, and Olin winked at me.
"Be seeing you, Nina," he said.
I didn't leave the front part of Nana and Grandpa Herman's house again until it was nearly time for the baby to be born. I stayed in there and read the letters Pammy snuck me from Ajita Patel, and then stuffed them into the inside of my pillow. Me and Ajita wrote back and forth to one another, but we didn't talk about school. We talked about ideas. She said she didn't think it was right that I'd been shut up that way, but that her family might do the same thing if she was in my condition. I told her that me and James didn't mean to sin, if we had sinned, and she said she understood, that she thought sometimes she'd like to have a boyfriend, but that her family had to pick hers out for her, and that one day, when she was older, they'd dress her up and take her to a photographer and make whole heaps of pictures to send out to boys she didn't know, Indian boys who were almost finished with medical school. Then those boys would decide if they wanted her for a wife. I told her that at Fire and Brimstone, it wasn't much different. We might be allowed to pick out some partners to choose from, but if they didn't have enough religious faith and weren't interested in converting, then Grandpa Herman would chase them off with his shotgun and tell them not to come back. I guess Pammy had told Ajita that I was making baby clothes, because sometimes in her letters she included pieces of lace. We didn't have lace ourselves, so I treasured the delicate white ruffles. I stitched lace to the bottom of a little pair of trousers and decided that my girl baby could wear pants if she wanted to. She wrote me again and asked if we married cousins out here, and I told her that we didn't marry close cousins. Then she said that she couldn't marry just any Indian boy, that she'd have to marry a Gujarati, because you're supposed to stick to your own caste. She said Gujaratis were priestly, but that the only Indian boy she knew outside her own family was a Rajasthani, which she explained was sort of like royalty, and she wouldn't mind marrying him, but her family would never allow it, and he wasn't planning on going to medical school anyway. He wanted to be a chef. That day she sent me some squares of Indian fabric, thin and patterned with tiny flowers. They had a funny smell, like the inside of a cardboard box that had been full of medicine and one flower, maybe. I didn't use the fabric for clothes, because I wanted to keep sniffing it. I'd sit in my bed for hours, a big white spread thrown over my lap, and I'd read her letters again and again, peeking out the window occasionally to see if the bus was coming, and hoping Pammy would bring me another one. I imagined Pammy bringing Ajita home with her for a visit one day, and though I knew it had never happen, I thought that if she sat on the other side of that swinging door, I'd stick my hand underneath just enough to touch the fabric of her pants. I was careful not to let the little loose edges of where she'd ripped the letter out of her notebook litter the bed or the floor. I picked them all up and stuffed them in the pillow, too. Ajita asked me if I'd be coming back to school whenever the baby was born, and I told her that I'd probably stay out until the next school year, because Grandpa Herman had refused to allow the county to send their homebound instructor to Fire and Brimstone, and even though he was going to have to go to court over it soon, by the time they got it settled, it'd be too late. I told her that I probably wouldn't be in her grade anymore, but she said there were some 8th and 9th grade classes combined, and maybe. It was almost time for the baby when Pammy brought my last letter. I could feel a pressure I hadn't felt before. Not a pressure, really. It was like whenever I sat up, I felt like I had something between my legs, and when I walked around, my legs didn't want to fit together right. So I was staying off my feet most all the time and leaning back whenever I could. In the last letter, Ajita asked me if I was going to take care of the baby myself, or if Mama would help me, and if I thought I'd ever get married one day, even though I'd already have a baby. For that last week before he was born, I tried to figure how to answer Ajita. I knew what to tell her about marrying somebody besides James. I couldn't, because I was a widow, even if it wasn't a legal kind of widowhood. but I just didn't know about the rest. The more pregnant I got, the less anybody wanted to talk about what would happen to it. Even Nana refused to talk about it, and I got an awful feeling that they might knock it in the head like too many girl puppies. I didn't know of anybody they'd killed before, at least not directly. But I knew that they believed more than anything else in punishing sin, and they thought my baby was sin personified. The closer it came to time, the more scared I got. I tried to get Grandpa Herman to give me some kind of indication. One night while we were praying, I asked him if my baby would be born a sinner.
"All babies are born sinners," he claimed.
"But will my baby be more of a sinner than Clyde and Frida's?"
"Well, I don't know about that," he said.
"Do you think you'll be able to love my baby anyway?" I asked him.
"Nina," he said, "we need to be focusing on the Word of God."
And then he started up again. "But wait, Grandpa," I stopped him. "Remember how when Mary had baby Jesus, nobody believed he was really the child of God at first? Remember?" He raised up his hand like he would strike me, but then he put it down.
"I don't ever want to hear you say something like that again. Do you understand me?"
he yelled.
"Your baby is not like Jesus, and I pray to God that the rapture won't come until you get yourself straight with your Maker, because if it does, you'll be left behind on this pitiful planet, left to have your limbs cut from your body by Satan's own army. But you won't die. I don't know how we failed you, but you've got to get your vision directed back on that cross, because those soldiers will cut off your fingers and toes one by one and toss them into a great vat of boiling grease, and you'll hear them sizzle as they land there. But you won't die. They'll cut off your legs and your arms, and you won't be able to move, but you won't die. And the scorpions will stick their giant tails into your body, will rape you with their stingers, and you'll wish you could die, but you won't. But Nina, my child, if you'll just repent, if you'll just admit that you sinned and that James sinned, and that the awful burden of that sinfulness caused him to leave this life, then you can go to heaven with us all. It won't be long, Nina, before Christ returns for his bride, for the Bible says that he'll come in the blinking of an eye. And if your heart's not ready, there'll be no hope for your soul, no salvation when the moon meets the sun."
"No," I said quietly.
"What?"
he demanded, and I looked at him only long enough to see his bushy red eyebrows bump into one another. Then I looked back into my big, big lap. "No, sir," I said. He left the room ranting about hard-headed women and the workings of the devil. Nobody came for a long time except Nana, who still rubbed my sore muscles and felt my belly, but didn't smile. "Tell me a story," I'd beg her.
"I can't, child."
"Please?"
"No, Nina, I don't have no stories today."
"You didn't have any yesterday either," I cried, "or the day before. What's wrong?"
"I have to leave you now," she said.
And when Daddy came in, he wouldn't look at me. He'd talk just like normal, about the weather and the new kind of chickens he'd heard about that grew feathers that fluffed out like rabbits, but he wouldn't look at me. "What's gonna happen to me, Daddy?"
"Nothing, baby."
"I mean, after it comes, are they gonna throw me out of fire and brimstone because I don't have any money?"
"Ain't nobody gonna hurt you. You're gonna move right back home with us,"
he said to his trousers. "What about the baby?"
"Honey, I can't talk about it. I just don't know."
There was nobody for me to talk to but Jesus, and I got tired of talking to him all the time, so I talked to the baby. "I won't let them hurt you," I said. "I'll stay with you forever, and if you ever sin, you can just say you're sorry and that will be enough. And you won't have no nettles in your crib either, because if anybody puts nettles in your little bed, I'll brush them off. I'll check your crib every day." I wondered if Daddy had made me a crib the way he'd made one for David and Laura. I thought maybe they'd give that crib to me, even though it was made short and I was taller than most. I didn't figure it would matter much. I prayed that I'd known enough of Jesus' pain already to be able to handle giving birth. Nana looked at me strangely when I asked for some pieces of barbed wire and told me that she wouldn't bring it. I tried to convince her that I wanted to use it in a rug, but she called me a liar and said, "Why would anybody walk on a rug with barbed wire in it?" She had a point. But Grandpa Herman was delighted to bring me the wire.
"Now you make sure you don't hurt yourself," he said to me, "'cause you can do your penance when the baby's delivered. You be careful where you put it."
I knew he wouldn't mind if I wrapped it around that baby, though. All he wanted was to think that I was trying to get close to God again. He didn't care if I got hurt. But I really was making a rug. I knew nobody'd walk on it, but I wanted to make a rug for James. I bent the barbed wire back and forth until it broke off into strips the right length. Then I cut the rope he'd tied around his waist and that tree to match. And then I took down my hair, combed it out, ran my fingers along the tops of my ears until they met at the back, and I lifted all that top hair up and got it out of the way. I put a rubber band at the base of my neck to cord off what was left hanging, and then went to work cutting above the rubber band. It took a long time because my hair was thick. It was more like sawing than cutting. By the time I'd cut just that bottom part off, I had more hair than most people have on their whole heads lying on the floor. Dark brown and more than 2 feet long. And when I took my other hair down, you couldn't hardly tell the difference. I worked all night on the rug. Tobacco twine and burlap, barbed wire and rope. I used my hair to weave in a big cross, right in the middle, and the barbed wire outlined it. I shredded up my fingers working on it, and the burlap had little bloodstains smeared all over. I wove for most of the night, and I cried a little too. When it was nearly day, when the rooster had already crowed, I tied off the ends and lifted up my rug for James that nobody would ever walk on. I climbed aching into bed, threw the rug across my feet, and slept. I woke up late and cramping just a little, and I knew I had to get out of the house. I didn't ask anybody if I could leave. I just left, and nobody stopped me. Most of the men had taken jobs outside the community for those cold months, and Grandpa Herman had ridden off to town to take care of some business. But the women were around. Most of them were inside, but I walked right past Nana, who didn't say a thing. And Wanda was traipsing back from the hen house when I passed her on the road. She looked at me funny and said, "Hey," and, "How you feeling?" But nothing else. I didn't have a coat big enough to go around me, so I'd taken the blanket off the bed again, wrapped it around me like a shawl, and set off for the woods. I walked out where the boys set their traps, and even checked the traps for them, but they hadn't caught any foxes that morning. I walked out to the creek, and even though I was heavy and aching, I crossed it and went to the tree stand where James killed his first deer. I tried to climb up the steps, but I didn't have the power, so I sat down at the base of the tree and remembered James, so gentle and confused, but so very, very dead. I thought it might have been better if I'd drowned myself beside him in that awful pond. Then we could have been like those people from great literature who took their lives for love. But I just wasn't that brave. I couldn't think of anybody I loved enough to die for, except maybe the baby. And I wasn't even sure about that. I knew I had some time. Nana had told me the pains would happen regularly when it was time for the baby, and I had some pains, but they weren't the kind that took my breath or the kind you could count with a watch. Sometimes I closed my eyes and talked myself out of having to use the bathroom, but I figured I had a good while. So I stayed there, in the woods, listening to the water in the distance, dancing over roots and across little sticks and rocks, listening to the leaves crunch beneath me as I tried to make myself comfortable. I did a little praying, but mostly for the baby, not for me. I prayed that nobody would trick it or scare it with horrible stories about revelations and plagues on the earth. I prayed that my baby wouldn't ever have to get up in the night to check the faucet and make sure it still had water. When it was time to go, I thought about staying. I thought I'd probably be better off alone, just squatting in some pine needles and having my child. And when it was out of me, I'd nurse it with my full breasts, and then I'd carry it over to the pond. We wouldn't have to swim across. We'd just have to walk around it, through some tangles and vines, and then we'd be on somebody else's property, maybe a nice Baptist family who wanted a young girl and her baby to bring up proper. But I left. I walked back to the house, slowly, my back feeling like somebody was pinching it from the inside, squeezing it so hard it made me grit my teeth. When I came inside, Nana was waiting for me, and she helped me get to my bed. "It's coming, ain't it?" Nana asked me. Not happy a bit. Not the way I wanted her. "Yes, ma'am," I said. "I think so." And when I went to sit down on the edge of the bed, that's when it started pouring out of me. All the water, pouring steady and hard, slippery down my legs. And for a second, I worried that I was having a fish, not a baby. I soiled the floor and my clothes and the blankets, and I just stood there looking down at it. I tried to stop it, like pee, but it didn't work. My legs wouldn't go back together. I couldn't even slow it down. "It's all right," Nana said. "It's expected." "Uh-oh," I kept saying. "It's all right," she reassured. Nana left me for a while, and when she came back, she brought me something to drink. I think it was alcohol, though I don't know where she got it, and I knew that drinking was a sin, but it seemed like I'd sinned so much already that a little more couldn't hurt. Then I remembered Ben Harback in the grave, and I said, "Nana, I don't want to sleep in a grave. Don't give me nothing that will get me in trouble." But she said, "Hush, child, and drink it." So I did. I knew that Grandpa called it Satan's own sweet piss, but it wasn't sweet at all. It scalded my throat and made me feel like if I tried to say something, it'd come out demonic and coughing. As soon as I finished one cup, she got me another one. But by then, I was having a pain. A real one. Worse than barbed wire in my skin. And I said, "Nana, you gotta tell me a story." But she said, "Shh," and gave me a piece of rubber that came off the back of the washing machine to bite down on. I was sure I was going to bite that thing in two. Then it let up for a minute, and I could feel the sweat on me, just like I'd been in a tobacco field in the middle of summer, except it was winter and different. "Uh-oh," I kept saying. "Uh-oh." "You'll make it through this," Nana promised. "Most everybody does." But I was thinking about James's mama, who had died doing just what I was doing. I was thinking about Dot, the horse, who bled everywhere. I knew I couldn't die, because then that baby would be stuck good, and if nobody killed it, it would have to live at Fire and Brimstone forever, and wouldn't have me there to whisper in its little ear that rapture or no rapture, it wouldn't be left behind. I wondered if the rapture happened at just that moment, if the pains would stop, and I almost prayed for it. But then I got another pain, a bigger one that hurt so much I messed myself without even knowing I was doing it. "Tell me a story," I begged. "I can't right now," Nana said. "I got to clean you up." And I was sorry in a way, embarrassed in a way, but mostly I just didn't care because I was caught in a wave of hurting that wouldn't break. Nana left with the dirty towels and came back with another drink for me. That time I chugged it just to have something to swallow. The next time when I cried out, Nana said, "Bite that rubber." So I put it back in my mouth, and I didn't even have to ask for a story, because she started telling it on her own. When Herman's papa died, he inherited a lot of land. More land than one man can handle, I reckon. We were living right here in this house, but not another thing was on this property. It was fields as far as you could see. You're breathing too fast, baby. Slow it down. In through your nose and out through your mouth. I hoped that I wouldn't choke on that piece of rubber. Usually I was adult enough not to choke, but it seemed like I'd lost control of most everything. Anyhow, Herman worked all the time, sun up until sundown, and even though he was right here with me, I felt lonelier than I'd ever felt before. My people was all the way over the swamp, and I didn't hardly ever see them except for on Sundays and Wednesday nights at church. "It's coming again, Nana," I panted. "Stop it." "Here, get you a piece of ice." And she picked up a thick sliver and stuck it in my mouth. I had little Ernest already, but having a child ain't always as much company as you think. "Uh-oh," I muttered through my mouth blocked off with a piece of washing machine and my tongue hanging on to that ice for all it was worth. "Don't fight it," Nana said. "Fighting it won't do no good. You might as well dive on in." "Uh-oh," I said again, in a voice so high that it mustn't have been mine, the whole world fading to purple, slowly, so that I thought I was going to knot up so tight I strangled myself trying to get little enough to fit through the circle of light. But then it let go. "Have you another drink?" Nana said, and I did. He'd come in nights, and I'd already have the baby asleep, and I'd be missing him so bad, wanting him to lay down with me for a while, because sometimes when you're lonely enough, you feel like there ain't no way out except having a little bit of another person fill you up, but Herman and eat and fall right asleep, she told me. I was trying to listen. I really was. And I wasn't hurting just then, but I was tensing up to get ready for the next round. Then in the morning, after all my sweet dreams when I'd been imagining things different, at the time of day when I felt full enough already, he'd wake me up feeling lonely, I reckon. I always figured we must be exact opposites, 'cause just when I'd be content, he'd have a need. Privately, I hoped there'd be another war, so he'd go off again, and I could take Ernest and go back to my people. "I ain't never told nobody that," she added. "Don't you repeat it." "Uh-oh," I huffed. "Nana." "Breathe," she coached. "In through your nose. Deep. That's good." And paused. "And out through your mouth." "Nana," I called. "It's okay," she said. And she rubbed me with oil to help my skin get ready to give. "Tell me a story," I hollered. "Shh," she begged. "Bite down." So when Herman got the idea for the church, I weren't that disappointed at all. In fact, I was happy. Course I feel guilty about it now, because I didn't care nothing about the religion exactly. I just wanted to have people close by. It was all I could do not to holler out. The room was reeling, and Nana was veiled by the anguish of it all. I kept imagining what it must feel like to die, on a cross or in a pond, either one. "Not that story. Tell me about your mama," I cried, and then coughed, and Nana gave me another piece of ice. But then the pain left me. Nana poured me another drink. We sat there quiet, and she rubbed at my stomach and between my legs, and I didn't even care, 'cause it was Nana. She ran out for a minute to wet me a cloth to put on my head and to get more ice. But it took her too long, and when she got back, I was halfway through my next pain, feeling like I was being torn wide open and leaving my teeth marks in the side of my arm because I'd dropped the piece of rubber and couldn't lean over to get it. When Nana saw me, she rushed over and sat beside me on the bed and wiped at my face, glancing occasionally at the clock on the night table. "Tell me about your mama," I raved. She was pretty, Nana said quickly. And she loved being that way. She'd sit in front of her vanity and brush her hair until I was sure it would all come out in her comb. No, I moaned, swirling off so far I needed to say something just to make sure I still could. Tell me about Weston Ward. He had hairy arms, Nana fell in, and you can tell how good they'll be at lovin' just by the hair on their arms. My papa didn't have much, but Weston's arms were like a bear, so he was that much closer to nature, and that much closer to being able to...
Uh-oh!
I interrupted as it peaked.
Uh-oh!
Breathe, she said, and I imagined her wiping her face, though my own eyes were closed by then. Breathe deep. When that one was over, I was crying. More tears than I'd ever had, maybe. And I wished James was there so he could see me hurting that way, because I hated him for leaving me to deal with it all alone. But only for a second. Then I wished Jesus could see me, too, hurting so much. But he wasn't there either. Nobody was. Or so I thought. Then I glanced at the window and saw that it was still daytime, though I thought it had to be the middle of the night. And I saw Pammy's little red face, her blue eyes big as plums, and peeking in. I started to holler out and tell her to leave, but then Nana gave me another drink, and I forgot, or just didn't care. What was Weston like? I asked Nana desperately, when I felt the surge begin again. He was a sweet man, Nana said, and I believe he loved Papa almost as much as Mama, except he loved her in another way. It was Papa he wanted to please, though, helping him out in the store and all. Mama just latched onto him because he was around. I can't do this anymore, I hollered. Mama? A voice called from the other room, and I knew it was my own Mama, but I didn't care. I'll be there in a minute, Nana hollered back. Stay out there. And right in the middle of another pain, she gave me a final swig. I couldn't hardly swallow, and I told Nana that, but she said, Drink it. You can't have no more. And so I did. Bite that rubber, she instructed. She'd picked it up sometime and washed it off and put it back beside me, but I hadn't even noticed. Don't leave me, I begged her. You'll be fine, Nana swore, and kept talking. It wasn't until I was older that I figured out that Papa wasn't able to satisfy Mama anymore, if you know what I mean. And even though she loved my Papa, she had needs that were bigger than that love. I reckon she was just lonely as could be, not having many women friends, and then not knowing how to talk to them about anything except the curtains or what she was making for dinner. I saw Nana look over at the window and spot Pammy, who ducked back down as soon as Nana turned her way. I was woozy and throbbing all over, but I said, Let her stay. Before the next pain happened, Nana went out to talk with Mama, and when Nana came back, she had Mama and Bethany and Wanda and Laura and Aunt Kate and Great-Aunt Imogen with her, too. They didn't all come into the bedroom, but they sat in the sitting room and kept sticking their heads in the door to tell me to hold on. Then I thought I was screaming, even though I tried not to, but it was just the tea kettle from the next room. Then the pains came again, but I don't remember them. I kept looking at Pammy's big eyes in the window and thinking, I'll help you feed the chickens tomorrow, because I knew I'd be flat by then. And then Laura was sitting beside me, dabbing at my face with a cloth and dropping ice into my mouth. And Mama was sitting next to my belly, her hand on it low, and saying, It's okay, Nina. You'll be all right. And I didn't know where Nana was until I saw her blurry between my legs, and I thought I might pass out, but she said, Push. So I did, and the whole rainbow fell down over me, all those colors blazing into each other slow, and she said, Push. And I did. And I saw flowers, big azaleas coming at me, and all I wanted to do was bury my head in their middles and swim in like a bee. But she said, "Push!" And so I did, and I saw a wooden boat on dark water, and I wanted to get in and float away until the boat turned into James, and she said, "Push!" And I did, and I saw James kissing the wound in Jesus' side, and I felt the snip, snip, snip of toenail scissors between my legs, but it didn't even hurt noticeably. It was all so huge by then. She said, "Push!" And I saw the 90-year-old baby whipping James and Jesus with a wet rope, but neither of them cared, and I didn't either, except that Laura was pushing the hair out of my face, and I said, "No!" And someone cried. Someone else. And I don't remember another thing. I slept off and on for a long time. I kept waking up, and Nana would be there, and I'd say, "Is it okay?" "I already told you, baby," Nana smiled. "He's fine."
"A boy?"
"Yes, child. Rest." So I'd go back to sleep, dreaming wildly things I couldn't remember when I woke back up. And then Grandpa Herman came in, and he was grinning, patting me on the head, and he said,
"You did it, girl. You gave us the new Messiah."
And I thought I must have been dreaming, but it seemed so real. Later, when I woke up again, Mama brought me some grits and fed them to me.
"He's just beautiful, Nina," she said somberly.
But I thought I mustn't be awake, really, because my baby was born from sin, so he couldn't possibly be beautiful, and I didn't know what to say. Wanda came in and brought me a rubber glove filled with ice, and she put it between my legs and then sat on the bed beside me.
"How you feeling?"
she asked me.
"Okay, I reckon. Where's my baby?"
Mama looked at Wanda, and Wanda looked back at her, and then Mama reached down and started stroking my face.
"The community decided that it would be best if David and Laura took him to raise. They've been wanting a baby so bad, you know. And you need to get back to school and do things with the other children. So we decided that if David and Laura raised him, you'd be his aunt. And you'd get to see him as much as you wanted and tend him every day. But he'd have two parents, like every child should have."
"Where is he?"
I whispered.
"He's with Laura and David," Wanda said. "And oh, Nina, they love him so much already. When your grandpa handed him to them, they cried and kissed him and prayed over him for an hour."
"I want to see him," I said. "Will you tell Laura to bring him by?"
"That wouldn't be good, honey," Mama said. "You can see him in a few days when you're feeling better."
I could feel a wetness all over me, coming mostly from my breasts that hurt so much that even breathing was unbearable.
"Can I feed him?"
I cried.
"They've got formula for him," Mama explained. "It'll be best if you just let your breasts dry up."
By that time the tears were coming hard.
"Did they name him already?"
I asked them through sniffles.
"Canaan," Wanda said.
"Isn't that beautiful? He's the promised land, Nina. Right here, at Fire and Brimstone."
I got better fast. Nobody believed I was better, but I was, even though every step made my mouth water with a throbbing. That next morning, early, I hauled my sore self out of bed and wrapped up in a blanket, even though I wasn't very fat at all, and probably could have fit into a coat if I'd had one, and I wandered out to David and Laura's house. When I beat on their door, David came to it. As he led me inside, he had tears in his eyes, and he said, "Nina, I don't think nobody will ever be able to give a gift as nice as the one you gave us." And he hugged me too hard. The watery milk poured out of me, and I could feel it dripping on my belly. Then Laura came into the room, and she couldn't say anything except,
"Oh, Nina, oh, Nina." and a part of me was glad to have made them so happy, to give them something they couldn't get on their own. But another part of me wanted to run into the back and steal Kanan away, to run for the road with him in my arms. I knew I couldn't run, but I kept imagining it just the same. "Can I see him?"
"Of course," David said, and smiled to Laura.
He put his arm around me and led me down the hall into their bedroom, where the crib Daddy had made was pushed up next to a wall. He was so tiny. I'd expected him to be bigger, pulling up on the side of the crib or something, because he felt big enough to be walking when he came out. But he was laying there asleep, with the covers pulled up over him, and he had dark hair already, and thin eyelids, so that I could see little red squiggles beneath the skin. I imagined that James must have looked just like that when he was new to this world. I was surprised to find Grandpa Herman in that room, sitting in a chair next to the crib, just watching him breathe. Grandpa Herman stood up and gave me his chair and helped me to sit. He put his heavy hand on my shoulder, and we all stood around the short crib, watching Kanan sleep.
"I didn't mean to doubt you, Nina," Grandpa whispered. "I didn't mean to falsely accuse you of fornication."
"Sir?" I asked, thinking that surely the fornication stuff had to be done with. It was a baby, after all, a beautiful human child.
"Did you see his little hands, Nina?" Laura asked me.
"No," I said. "Is something wrong with them?"
"No, Peanut," David said. "They're perfect. Look."
And he pulled back the blanket so I could see. His tiny hands were held together, just like he was praying, peacefully, in his sleep. I stood up, leaned over the crib, and touched his perfect skin. I touched his fingers, so long already, and examined his fingernails. But when I tugged at one miniature hand, the other one moved with it. I ran my finger between his fingers, down to his palms, and found that they were seamed together, perfectly, at the heart line.
"How did this happen?" I whispered.
"It's a sign from God," Grandpa Herman beamed. "The world will surely end in this perfect child's lifetime. He's the new Messiah, come to lead his people."
"He was born this way?"
"Of course," Laura answered.
"You ain't surprised, are you? You said all along it was Jesus's baby."
"No," I said. "I'm not surprised." It didn't take long for everything to make sense to me. I could understand why Nana hadn't wanted to talk about what would happen after the baby was born. She knew already that David and Laura would take him. And Daddy knew, too. I began to understand why Mama wouldn't even come visit. She didn't want to tell me. Nobody wanted to give the secret away. I decided the grudges you hold for betrayal might be the very meanest kind. It wasn't that they gave my son to my brother that hurt so much. It was knowing that they'd been talking about it, plotting it, worrying over how I'd react and praying about it behind my back. And I felt stupid and tricked again. I'd made them Christmas presents. But all that madness got mixed up once I saw Kanan's hands. It made me wonder if they were planning on killing him all along and decided not to after they saw that he was holy. It made me wonder if he was holy, if maybe I really was knowing Jesus and not James, because why else would his hands be that way? And if Kanan was a sign from God, a new Messiah sent here to lead us, then what did that make me? It was hard for me not to let the good treatment go to my head. When I left David and Laura's that first day, Barley was working on some kind of little motor just outside. He stopped when he saw me, and I reckon that dragging that blanket behind me, I did look kind of like royalty.
"Wow, Nina," he said. "All that time I thought you was just an average..."
Well, you know, slut. And come to find out, you're chosen by God.
I didn't say anything to him. I didn't know what to say.
'Cause I didn't mean to think bad of you or nothing,
Barley added, and wiped his hands on the front of his pants.
Can I help you back in the house?
Thank you, I said, and took his arm. He directed me to Mama's house instead of Nana's, though.
Look here, Bethany said, opening the door for me. How are you, Nina?
Fine, mostly, I said. She helped me over to the couch, and I was glad to have her there, because I felt a little bit like I was walking with a boat between my legs.
I believed you all the time, Bethany whispered. I knew you and James wouldn't do nothing like that.
Can I get you something to drink? Mama asked, and I said, yes, and then juice.
Put your feet up, Bethany said. You hurting?
Some, mostly sore.
Pammy, get a rubber glove and fill it with ice for Nina, Bethany instructed.
And Pammy, who'd been standing against the wall and looking at me, like if she got too close I might shock her with my holy electricity, obliged.
Maybe by next week I can help you with the chickens again, I told her as she handed it to me.
You don't have to do that no more, she insisted.
Well, why not? I said playfully. Didn't you miss me?
Yeah, she said. But you're different now.
She's our same old Nina, Mama told Pammy. Are you ready for school? The bus will be here shortly.
Yes, ma'am, Pammy said, and left.
And who'd have thought that we'd have the mother of the new Messiah right here among us and not even know it? Bethany wondered. My own little sister.
She was talking like I'd parted the sea when all I'd done was sinned with her stepson. Or maybe not.
I want you to see your room, Mama said. Do you feel like walking up the stairs yet? 'Cause I painted it fresh.
Maybe I'll wait till tomorrow before I try that. I think I want to go back to Nana's and rest a while.
That'll be fine, Mama said. Here, I'll help you. And when you feel like it, we'll get Mustard and Barley to move your things back home.
It wasn't until I was in bed again that I started wondering where Daddy was. I hadn't seen him since the baby was born, and he was one of the only people who'd been around when I was pregnant. It didn't make good sense. But when I got Nana alone, instead of asking her about Daddy, I asked her about Canaan.
Did you know they were going to take him from me?
I caught wind of it, she said tersely.
Well, why didn't you tell me? I cried.
Seemed like every time I cried, my breasts hurt more and leaked out hard to keep my eyes company.
I didn't know how, Nana said, holding my head. I didn't know what to think about the whole thing. Didn't know what you'd want or not want. I didn't like the idea, personally. But you gotta think about the greater good, I reckon. When the idea struck them to give the child to David and Laura, I knew you'd get to be with it and help tend it, and you'd still be free to finish school. But I thought if I told you, you'd try to leave Fire and Brimstone, and I reckon it was selfish of me. But I just couldn't imagine being here without you.
Oh, I said. We didn't talk for a while. She had her hands at the back of my head where I'd cut the hair away, and I could feel her measuring it and learning of what I'd done, but she didn't mention it at all.
Nana, do you think my baby is the new Messiah?
I think your baby was born with a simple problem that would have been fixed already if we'd taken you to the hospital where you belonged.
So you don't think I'm special?
You've always been special, child, she said. But one little hinge of skin don't make no baby a Messiah.
What will we do about it? I asked her.
Right now, the best thing to do is leave things alone till they settle over.
We'll get a doctor to cut his hands apart sooner or later, but I'll have to work on Herman for a while first. I done studied them little hands good, and it wouldn't take but 2 or 3 stitches in each one. That night was my last night at Nana's. There wasn't much for me to collect. David and Laura had taken all the baby things I'd made, so all that was left was a few garments and my rugs and looms. I pulled James's rug out of the closet to look at it again, and I thought that the only thing missing, the only thing that would make us a family, me and James and Canaan, even if it was an imaginary family, was the blood from childbirth. So I placed the rug over my sheet that night, and eased myself down onto the edge of it, slipping off my underpants, and letting the leftover bleeding stain Canaan onto my hair and James's rope. I guess everybody was still trying to protect me, because nobody wanted me to know that after Canaan was born, Daddy left Fire and Brimstone and didn't come back for 3 days. I kept asking about him, but people'd say, "I believe he's off looking at a man's tobacco beds in Wachusa," which was 100 miles away, or, "I think he's gone to help with a revival in Cedar Bluff," which was 100 miles in the other direction. People told me that they thought Daddy might be scouting for migrant workers or running a load of lumber up to North Carolina, but nobody got their story straight, and everybody seemed so frazzled when I asked that they just said the dumbest things. Mustard won the prize. He said, "I believe Grandpa Liston's in the bathroom, Nina. That's where he was last time I saw him." "He must have the drizzling shits, then," I told him, "'cause he's been in there for ages." Mustard put his hand over his mouth, but giggled out anyway. He was helping me pack up my rugs into brown paper sacks, folding them just the way I told him. From the side I could see the hairs on his face beginning to get fuzzy, though they were still blonde. "What? You never heard nobody say shit before?" I played. "Shit, shit, shit. I'm the new Mother of God, and I hereby declare that shit is a word worth using here at Fire and Brimstone." "Nina!" He laughed. "What? You can't make up the rules like that. You'll get nettles or even dunked again." "They better not dunk the Mother of God," I joked. "You ain't the Mother of God," Mustard swore. "You and James did it, and I know 'cause I watched." "No, you didn't," I moaned, but blushed. "Did too," Mustard said. "But don't worry, I ain't gonna tell, 'cause you deserve to be treated good for a change. How many of these rugs did you make?" "I don't know, 30 or so, and I wouldn't say shit to nobody but you," I whispered. "Mustard, where's Daddy?" "I ain't got no idea," he promised. "Last time I saw him was at the ceremony." "What ceremony?" "Where Laura and David stood at the front of the church, and great-grandpa Herman blessed Canaan and put him in their arms. Grandpa Liston cried so hard he snuffled like a pig. I don't know why, exactly, 'cause Canaan's still his grandson, no matter whether he grows up with you or with David and Laura." "Did you see him leave?" "No. But Barley said he got in the truck and drove off right afterwards, without telling nobody where he was going." Mustard picked up 2 bags of rugs and began the haul to Mama and Daddy's house. I walked with him, but I didn't carry anything. "Do you think he'll come back?" "Grandmama Ree says he will," Mustard answered. "She said he was just upset and needed a little vacation." "But he don't have money," I worried. "He's got a little bit," Mustard confided. "He didn't give everything he made this winter to Fire and Brimstone. He saved up just in case."
"In case what?"
"Well, just in case Great-Grandpa Herman didn't want you to stay here after the baby came."
"How do you know?"
"He's played hooky from church about every Sunday with me and Daddy," Mustard allowed. "But nobody else don't know that about the money, so don't go around mentioning it."
Later it struck me that for everybody to be so upstanding and honest at Fire and Brimstone, it sure did seem like they lied a lot. Not telling me about what would happen with the baby, making up tales about where Daddy'd gone. And of all the people I knew at Fire and Brimstone, sometimes it seemed like Nana, who everybody knew to have a past with lying, lied the least. The first night that I slept in my old bed, back in Mama and Daddy's house, Daddy returned. It was late at night, and I was already asleep when he came to my bed and sat down. "Nina," he called, and I thought at first it must be a dream. "Nina?" "Hey," I said, and sat up. There was a nightlight burning orange on the wall behind him, and it lit him up from the back. "Where were you?" I leaned into him and started hugging him, and even though he put his arms around me too, it didn't seem like he was hugging me back. "I had to go off for a while," he started. "Had to get some things straight in my mind." And I thought he might be crying, so I reached up to touch the skin under his eyes, and he was. "I'm sorry, Daddy," I said, keeping my thumbs there, pushing the water back.
"Don't need to be," he told me. "You ain't the one."
"What's wrong?" I tried. It seemed like so much could be wrong, like Daddy probably had 100 things to pick from.
"Do you want to stay here?" he asked me. "At Fire and Brimstone? 'Cause we can leave, Nina."
"Who?" I said. "Me and you and Mama?"
"Me and you," he said. "We can go somewhere else."
"Where?" I asked him.
"I don't know,"